Hello, everyone. Welcome to this new episode of the FinTech Scotland podcast. Today, we'll be speaking about scaling up a FinTech business. Very interesting topic. And more specifically, we're going to discuss resilience, big word resilience, and how it should be a very important consideration to protect customers, clients, adhere to new regulation, be investor ready, navigate the procurement better and faster, all those things that are very important to scaling up FinTechs. So we will explore that resilience and what it means. We'll cover cyber resilience as well, of course, but in a much wider way, we'll look at how to build a solid and future-proof business. So I guess this week our experts in the field and can talk for hours about the topic, so they've promised they'll try to keep on time. Our first guest is Wayne Scott, Regulatory Compliance Solutions Lead at NCC, one of our strategic partners. Hi, Wayne, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for joining us. Could you tell us a bit more about NCC and your role there?
Yeah, of course. I have a terrible job title of Regulatory Compliance Solutions Lead. But what that means is I personally liaise with the global financial services regulators. I co-write our consultation paper responses and anything to do with outsourcing and resilience and supply chain. I sit within the Software Resilience Division, which is a section of NCC Group. We focus on building stressed exit plans. Part of my role is to do some public speaking, some lecturing, mentoring, but also to make sure that our products here meet global regulatory requirements. It's NCC itself has been around in one guise or another, since 1966. But we went through a management buyout to spin out the profit-making sections of what was the National Computer Center. And that's where Technology Escrow was born. From there, we built a pretty dominant cybersecurity practice. I think we still have the largest team of ethical hackers on the planet. So we do everything from sort of code checks to full spectrum attacks.
Fabulous. Thank you. You're definitely the right person to have on this podcast then. We're also joined by David Lank, founder and CEO of Scottish FinTech IonBurst. Thank you for joining us, David.
Yeah, thanks, Mikhail, and a real pleasure to contribute today with Wayne, of course. Tell you a little bit about IonBurst.
Please do, yes.
We're at kind of the other end of the spectrum from NCC, which I actually used to use in my corporate days. IonBurst basically focuses on the cloud. It's a, you'd call it a cloud data transformation layer for storage, but it's ultimately going to be a communications technology. And the cloud's a lot more complex. That's the purpose behind IonBurst. A lot more complex than the on-premise world. And when you need to think about how we look at data with all these hacks, etc., people are after our data. We should never forget that. So we considered a new paradigm in data protection and protecting data from the inside out. And this comes from my old work when I was in the cards industry, when we rolled out chip and pin and then put EMV, the what you know as 3D secure or MasterCard secure code. So it was very important that we could try and deal with people and protecting people. But obviously people, what we found was hackers were after our data. And that's kind of what spawned fraud, money laundering, all these kind of nasty things like ransomware that we had. So we've been in a kind of cyber war for 20 years now. So the purpose behind IonBurst is to deal with that. So unlike other solutions, basically what IonBurst does is it brings us the innovation to embed security, privacy, sovereignty, and anytime availability, i.e. resilience and recovery, into every data object. So data becomes ultimately ultra secure, resilient shards. So we still use the base technologies that are used in the world. So we build in what's there. But what it means is we can keep data safe in transit and when stored. So that defines a new paradigm in data protection, because what we then start to do is protect data as a sovereign, valuable asset, wherever it travels, wherever it's stored, in open, public, or in hostile environments. That's one of the issues that people are saying with about the communications. Do we need, what do we do about, quantum decryption. How do we deal with that? Well, that's really dealing with the world of asymmetric encryption, whereas we're trying to say, well, okay, there are other routes for that. So that brings this kind of new concept of a multi-layered data protection that brings this future-proof unpredictability and complexity. So what we're trying to always do, this is one of the things Wayne's always trying to test in these ethical hackers, is try to render data useless to adversaries, understanding that it may be just too difficult for us always to protect it from them. But it always needs to be recoverable by authorised parties. And that's why resilience is so important.
I think we're going to get along here, David.
This is the first of a six-part series.
Fantastic. So listen, guys, let's just dive into the topic of today. And maybe, Wayne, let's start with you. Can you start by telling us what, in your world, being resilient mean?
Interestingly, I've got a funny feeling that David and I are going to come from this from the same angle. You know, I mean, outside of technology, resilience is a pretty well documented concept. It's sports or football as an example, but in the context of technology, what we do is we tend to focus on cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is often interchangeable with resilience, but you know, you would never say a good footballer is a secure footballer. You know, there's more to it than that. You know, security is part of resilience. It's maybe the main part of resilience, but it's just the start of it. You know, security is sort of the first two stages, if you like, resisting adversity and absorbing adversity. But the latter two stages is much where I'm looking at and more concerned with, really. It's recovering from adversity and learning from it. And that's often forgotten, you know, because for you to have plans on how to recover kind of means that you've taken the time to understand the ramifications of your own failure. It's sort of the opposite of the entrepreneurial mindset, really. It's assuming your own failure, planning for your own failure, and planning to learn from your own failure. So I think where David's coming from, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, you know, this idea of making the technology of making the data unrenderable is allowing for failure. Is that fair to say, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world has been, the on-premise world was a different paradigm entirely. You know, we had firewalls, we had physical firewalls, which were called data centers, and we had our security around them. You know, we had, you know, access controls, we had IAM controls for people's access management, their authentication and authorization. You know, we then had, you know, everything from device controls through to network controls. But what about the data? At some stage, the data is sitting around. Now, in a data center, that's fine. But what happens in cloud? You don't own the infrastructure. Somebody else is looking after your data. But there's this thing called the shared responsibility model that the cloud hyperscalers use. See, that's your responsibility.
Yeah.
And we now have regulators that say that's your responsibility. And then we've got the EU that says, there's a thing called sovereignty. And then, so they all say, as you would say in the traditional paradigm, Wayne, okay, let's have many backups. And then, of course, you get the climate control lobby saying, can't be having that. You need to cut the amount of data. Because all of that data floating around just makes our attack vector of data much bigger for an adversary. And if you don't know where your data is in cloud or where it's being stored, how can you tell you're going to recover? How do you know, even if you don't know where it is or how many copies there are, how you can recover it? A hyperscaler like an AWS, sorry, Wayne, I'll just finish this bit because it's quite important, I think. A hyperscaler like an AWS or a Microsoft Azure, they have what they call high availability. So they've extended the world of on-premise, you know, fault tolerance and mirroring data centers, etc., into their data centers. So you typically have maybe three data centers. And they will just basically run away and they'll be in parallel. And so guess what that means? Three copies of data. What happens if you have a little fault or you have to do a re-upload because, you know, you lose your connection? Where's that data? How do you know it's protected? How can I protect it now so that if I really need it back, I can get it back? And that's the problem we have with the cloud. It's such a big, big, complex beast. Sorry, back to you, Wayne.
No, nothing to pass back to. Definitely coming from the same point of view is that discussion focuses on the security of it, but you know it's about availability. It's about being able to stand something back up assuming at some point that there will be a failure. How do you recover from that? The same rules apply to, you know, on-premise, but you know, in theory, you know, the on-premise services should be more stable, you know, not subject to constant patches and upgrades and bug fixes. You know, to roll out an upgrade on an on-premise solution, it's a good 2-month affair if we're talking core stuff, and there's a load of checks go, but cloud stuff gets updated continually, but we only talk about and we only look at the security of it, and that shared responsibility, you know, is getting driven home more and more in the regulations as we go along. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, there's a really good, I forget the chap's name, but there's a US general who was asked at one stage when they'd had their previous hack, not the current one, about security, and he said, "Well, give me resilience every day." He says, because we build the 50-foot wall and we think we're safe, and then the adversary builds the 51-foot ladder. And they go, and that's the problem with security. It's a zero-sum game. You just don't know. And as Wayne said, in the on-premise world, it's tough enough, but you've got a controlled environment. You could argue that privacy and security are kind of synonymous, because if your data's sitting on your data centers and it's not going anywhere, well, actually, that's okay. But as soon as you start to let that data out and third parties get their hand on it, it's a different animal. And as Wayne said, patch control. Well, how often are people saying we've got great tech out here, but then there's the whole cloud community and the whole concept of open source software. It's fantastic for now. Most fintechs, Mikhail, will have some level of open source software in their componentry, but you have to keep the patches up to date. How do you know it's always secure? And that's the kind of stuff that Wayne's crowd can do brilliant jobs on, to just do the code checking, etc. But not everybody can afford that. And, you know, not everybody's got the skills for it. Another issue, skills. It's not just the fact we need the skills, it's the fact we don't have them. It's kind of just, that's a complexity. And that's why we need better ways of keeping resilience, because in the absence of being able to create your concrete bunker around your data, and metaphorically, you need to be able to assure yourself that you can get your data back, or maybe not even yourself, but your customer.
Absolutely. And David, you touched on something earlier, which is regulation. And Wayne, I know that that's your bread and butter. Okay. Are there any new regulations coming into place that fintech should be aware of in terms of resilience?
You know, Mikhail, the short answer is loads. Absolutely loads. There's a lot globally going on. Resilience has been the regulatory hot topic, you know, for quite a few years now. We've got four sets ongoing here through the SS221 and Financial Market Infrastructure Regulations, Critical Third Party Regulation here in the UK at the end of the year, DORA in Europe, FINMA, OSFI in Canada. All the states will announce, all the different regulators in the states will announce theirs in the coming months. Hong Kong and Singapore, Australia announced this morning that they'll be releasing theirs in the next month or so. And these regulations are broad, but they're kind of future-proof. They're not prescriptive. But they don't just apply to the financial institutions. They'll apply to systemically important suppliers too. So you'll see some big players being directly regulated by the financial services regulators. And I'd argue it's all necessary. You know, in the UK alone, we've had some pretty close calls when it comes to supplier failure. And by close calls, I mean big failures that cost the UK billions of pounds. It's been conclusively proven that following every economic shock, IT failures occur more frequently, they last longer, they're more severe and they actually cost more to fix. And if you just sort of look at the global economy over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had some huge economic shocks. Brexit, COVID, inflation, war, a couple of banks failed recently, and all of that, what it does is it puts financial pressure on the software supply chain. I mean, luckily, the regulations are all very similar globally, and the UK does lead the way on these regulations. So if you're compliant within the UK, then you'll be more than compliant everywhere else. And a lot of these resilience regulations do rightly focus on cybersecurity, but they all go to, in some form or other, name some new risks of supplier failure and service deterioration and concentration risk, non-cyber related risks. The regulators, all they have different names for them, stressed exit plans or separation plans, but it's essentially some plans that allow you to test and demonstrate that you can withstand shocks, and in the, say, the UK, Hong Kong, Singapore, India, Pakistan, one service that we do here at NCC that I'm primarily focused on, of technology escrow, is being named as a valuable component of these successful stressed exit plans, mainly because it's proportional, it's cost effective, it's not intrusive. You know, it's been around since 1984.
I guess from your perspective, both of you, when it comes to businesses going from startup to scale ups, where they really need to consider being resilient, not only because it's important for the security of the data, but also because they're going to be looking for big investments. They're going to be looking at working with large financial institutions, for example. Do you think that resilience is front of mind? And if not, why and how to change this?
I'm happy to start on that one, Wayne. This is a really important one, and I think it's a great question. The answer, I would say, is unfortunately not. This is a McAfee study done a couple of years ago. Is really, really quite telling. I did, I think it was about 1,400 IT leaders around the world, you know, and basically they asked them, well, again, you all want to move to cloud, get the benefit of that. Who looks after your data? 69% of IT leaders said, oh, the cloud hyperscalers responsible for my data. You know, they look after it. They make sure it's secure. And 12% actually believed they were completely responsible for it. Well, Wayne will tell you that regulators will have a different view of that. And this comes back to lack of understanding. And this is the problem with, I think it's a problem with where we've come from, and it's a generational problem of leaders in IT right now have come from the on-prem world where we used to outsource and it was very clear there's a contract, we do stuff. That's where I traditionally got NCC involved. Like, all the stuff goes in there, that's it, escrow done. We're all happy. You're responsible for this. I pay you that. Away you go. That's not the way the cloud works. And if you think about cloud customers, including fintechs, they need to understand really what they're responsible for, especially the data, its security, privacy, and sovereignty. And that all comes back to resilience, because ultimately, you need to make sure you can get the data back. And you still have to do configuration management in cloud. The cloud hyperscaler, they can do it, but it'll cost you a fortune. And you've got to make sure you're secure, the security, privacy, and resilience of your code base. So how do you know it's secure? How do you know you can get it back? Because if you lose it, where is it? Or if somebody's taken it away and stolen it, can you claim it? That kind of thing. You just get into all these problems. And have you got the skills to manage the data and your installations in cloud or wherever? Because it's not just in cloud. We build in cloud, but we can go on-prem. It's rather easier the other way around. And how do you make sure you've got appropriate resilience against cloud disruption? I mean, the OVH case a couple of years ago where they lost their first data center, unfortunately their backup data center was above it, is maybe not the classic example of what we should be talking about. But the only battle cry OVH could give to its customers is, look to your backups. to which a lot of the customers said, but that was in your second data center. So you've got to take responsibility. Don't expect somebody else to do it just because they're selling your service. And that's kind of the key thing you have to have front of mind. Now, it's really important if you're dealing with customer data, because customers will rely on you, and they may have much more draconian legals around that. So education, when you're trying to, how do we fix this? Education is really important. As Wayne says, people are starting to understand about this shared responsibility model, because more people want to go to cloud and they want to understand how to deal with it, concentration risk, etc. But the problem is that's a hard way. A lot of customers will just expect privacy, security, resilience, and carbon benefit. They just expect it. Security is not very cool, and actually, as for resilience, that's so low in the basement, I don't have to worry about it. But it's so important, as Wayne said, when we have these economic shocks, it's quite telling how they have the after effect on our economy and our infrastructure. So that's part of the issue I see. But, you know, if you understand the world of cloud a bit better, then there's a little bit of education. Look for organizations that can help. NCC can help. There are lots of other organizations that can help. Or even FinTech Scotland, dare I say, you know, we have a good community of people who've got expansive knowledge across the range of your fintechs. We have to learn. There isn't a book on this. We're not quite making it up as we go, but there isn't a book yet. So
and that's it. You want to say, right, David? And you're like, if I was to reverse engineer a resilient business, what I do is I look at the failed ones, and then if you look at the sort of the where and how and why, and you look at, I look at like the causes of failed fintechs and the ramifications of that, and the single biggest contributing factor to nearly every notable ISV failure documented within financial services over the last two decades is strategy, and namely an incentive-based culture within the ISV, within the provider. People do the wrong thing when there's lots of money involved. They take risks when there's lots of money involved. They, you know, cut corners when there's money involved. And that then becomes the operating model, the business model, and the sales model. Yeah, but behavior-based reward structures lead to a more resilient business, you know, rather than a financial target-based culture. But that's kind of seen as being in opposition to rapidly scale. A company that can scale rapidly has got to be resilient, because it's just change all the time. But you can't sort of cut corners on the culture. There's still got to be an ethos of efficacy that runs through everything you do, because it's financial services that's ultimately put at risk from a non-resilient business model. Does that make sense?
It does. It's 100% sense. And Mikhail probably didn't think we'd get onto this, but you're absolutely right. It's interesting when I look at it, because people say to me, well, you know, surely, I mean, you've got your products out there. Surely you're not just trying to scale. So, well, you know, I can't afford to scale something on an MVP in security and resilience has to be right. Unfortunately, we can't just say, try it. It might work 80% of the time. It has to work. And that puts a far different complexion on how you run a business and exactly how you incentivize. So of course, we're a startup, we incentivize people, but they're incentivized on getting stuff right, getting the security corner right, having security and resilience and privacy and sovereignty, all these kind of things that are important in cloud, and the carbon benefits. These things are part of our scoreboard, our balanced business scoreboard. Of course, you go into business with a view to making profit, but it has to be good profit. And the only corollary of that would be the downside for me of perhaps not pushing further into financial services is I get dragged into defense. Now, I don't want to necessarily be focusing on defense, because that doesn't enable me to keep mom and pop businesses safe. But and or healthcare, but it's kind of it's a sign that actually the tech works, the tech is good. We get people validating it. We get AWS validating it. We get AWS saying, for those of you that are a bit reluctant to use our S3, use this. This gives you what you may need. And it's patience. Coming back to the behaviors, you can get the right behaviors in the team, because I don't want that sales culture, because it's a very different culture. So we'll do partnerships. That's another thing. Keep my business resilience, because we're now talking about business resilience there, so that I can keep my customers' businesses resilient. But it does have the implications. And from an investor point of view, that understanding isn't quite there yet either. You need to have, you know, investors who understand, if you're in this kind of field, who understand this is what you need. And not just, those investors aren't just people with money. Those investors are the large companies that have got the capabilities and the need. So it's a challenge. And that's part of this. Again, we haven't written this book yet. This book's in process. You know, we're still going through the experience the book will be written on, as to what this era in cloud computing, moving to edge computing, etc., looked like, and how we got there.
Well,
I do believe exactly what you just said. That's 100% right.
Let's speak about that book, though. I'm interested in that book that's not written yet. So I'm a fintech entrepreneur. I've listened to this podcast, and you have me convinced that I'm not looking at resilience enough, and I should really focus on it. Where should I start, and what are the resources available?
Well, I've been banding a term around now for about 3 years. I don't claim to have invented it. Some gentleman that invented it was a sports psychologist. But, you know, we're all familiar with the concept of security by design. It's not too much of a leap to start talking about resilience by design. Whenever I say that to anybody in financial services, anybody in tech, they nod. Obviously, I can't see you gentlemen here at the moment, but everybody seems to instantly get and understand what that is as a concept whenever I band it around. I actually have put it into a couple of my consultation paper responses, and some regulators have included resilience by design within their regulations, even though it's not necessarily full mapped out as yet. But the places that I've seen that help, I don't know if you've come across the Center for Finance Innovation and Technology that's being set up at the moment. I think that they're going to play a big part in the coming years. It seems like a wonderful initiative. I know FinTech Scotland are involved in it on some levels.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The bit that interests me within there is the FinTech Passport. This idea of a sort of a kite mark for British fintechs, you know, I'm sure resilience would play part of that. David's touched on it. I lean a lot on, I'm based in Manchester. I lean a lot on Manchester academia. Not many people just go out and have a chat with the universities anymore, seemingly. But, you know, if I ever want any startling insight on how regulation doesn't affect innovation, you know, I pop out and go and speak to the Alliance Manchester Business School. Or if I want to understand what research projects are going on, I'll go and have a chat with ladies and gents over at Salford University or Manchester Met University.
It is an interesting point about that. Can you talk about the kind of resiliency? I had a really interesting debate. Let's say it was a debate with a lawyer that was a competition lawyer, and then into the whole concept of sovereignty and what was going on with the EU, Schrems II, that kind of stuff, when the US decided to have the Cloud Act and mucked everything up for everyone. And I said, well, sovereignty. He said, well, you now need to keep all your data in the EU sovereign kind of block area. I said, well, how does that work for resilience? You lose the whole of AWS, for example, loses the whole of its European cloud system. What are you doing? They can't keep the data in the States. And I said, well, we can shard it and spread it and make sure it's all. Oh, no, but that's the. I said, no. When's data? I said, that's where you keep the metadata. I said, we haven't even thought about how we can be more clever and still give resilience, even if you lose a whole cloud system. And this is part of the issue we have to do. You know, in the on-premise world, you've got maybe backup, you've got your RAID servers, you have maybe mirrored servers, you may have even your data center synced up. And at some stage, somebody comes along with a whole outsource arrangement where you've got your kind of disaster recovery. But what happens when we're all in cloud and we're all working from home, and the concept of resilience and recovery, which are slightly different things. I want my data back now. I want that particular file because that's important. It has to be on demand available. And this is the concept of resilience by design that Wayne's talking about. It's absolutely right, because it's the cadence at which we're pushing data into cloud and need to get it out. Another piece of information, 68% of the data we shove into cloud, or we store generally, 50% of the data we store is generally in cloud now. 68% of it is put there and never accessed again. So we may need it. We don't know we need it. How can we minimize the attack vector and that, keep it resilient, and also have something where regulation can sit side by side with commerce, protecting consumers as it must, but not stifling our ability to meet all these other initiatives like carbon, etc., and making sure that the legal authorities are comforted and assured that the data can be kept safe, but allow the world to kind of innovate. And that's one of the biggest challenges. And that's, I think, one of the things that certainly the banking industry is going to hit, because their whole concept of concentration risk is, you can't just have three teams doing everything on three cloud hyperscalers all the time. It's just not cost effective going forward, and it becomes a regulatory nightmare to manage anyway. So we need better solutions, and I certainly welcome the initiative. I hadn't heard of it, but I welcome it and would be certainly keen to get involved.
Fabulous. Well, listen, guys, we're reaching the end of this podcast episode. I just wanted to say a huge thank you to both of you. That was a very, very interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. So thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And to our audience, we'll be speaking to you again soon. Thank you for listening. Until next time.